The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, Continued. The crowd of 400 persons was perhaps the biggest of the campaign, and it was applauding and cheering the familiar lines. There is only one issue the voters of the 10th District face, that is, whether they stand with the President. When Johnson, who again had been supporting himself on the rail while speaking, doubled over, white-faced, and sat down, with his arms across his stomach. Some of the audience came up and, after hearing about the pain, told him he must have appendicitis. But he got up and, after apologizing to the audience for the interruption, finished the speech. Then, as the audience filed past him, he began shaking hands. Sherman Birdwell, coming up to congratulate him, noticed that he was covered with perspiration, and he was constantly wiping his brow. He whispered to Birdwell, "I'm sick. Stand here beside me." He had shaken almost all the hands when he had to sit down again. This time he couldn't stand up, and Lee, with Birdwell helping him, got him out to the car and drove him home, and then to Seton Hospital. Doctors there said, Lee and Mrs. Johnson recall, that his appendix was on the point of rupturing. They operated almost immediately. "There had been such mad rushing for so long," Lady Bird Johnson recalls, "and then everything came to a sudden dead stop. There was this dreadful day of hiatus, and then the election." Shortly after the polls closed on Saturday evening, Sam Stone's Williamson County vote, 3,180, was announced, putting him some 2,400 votes ahead of Johnson. But outside Williamson, Stone did very poorly, and as the votes came in from other counties, Johnson soon passed him. He soon passed all the other candidates, and pulled steadily ahead throughout the evening. The official totals for the major candidates showed Houghton Brownlee with 3,019 votes, C.N. Avery with 3,951, Stone with 4,048, Polk Shelton with 4,420, Merton Harris with 5,111, and Lyndon Johnson with 8,280, 3,000 votes more than his nearest opponent. "When I come back to Washington," Johnson had vowed, "I'm coming back as a congressman." Now, less than 2 years later, he was coming. Chapter 22. From the Forks of the Creeks. Analyzing in detail the results of the special election for congressman in the 10th Congressional District of Texas in 1937, breaking it down by ethnic groups or age brackets or educational levels, is an unrewarding exercise, for the results are both too small and too fragmented to have much significance. Although the district's population was estimated at 264,000, only 29,948 persons, one out of every nine residents of the district, went to the polls. And of those voters, only 8,280 cast their votes for Lyndon Johnson. Johnson won the election, in other words, with less than 28% of the vote, with only one out of every four votes cast. He won, moreover, with the votes of little more than 3% of the district's population. He was congressman from a district in which only one out of every 32 persons had voted for him. Some 41,000 votes had been cast in the 1936 Democratic primary, which Buchanan won. Johnson had been elected with the fewest votes, by far the fewest votes, of any of the nation's 435 congressmen. In a broader context, however, the election was significant for two reasons. One, of course, was that it set Lyndon Johnson on the path of elective office that would lead him to the presidency, and that would lead America to the Great Society and to Vietnam. The other was the identity of the people who set him on that path. They were not the people of the plains. Half the district consisted of prairies, and Johnson lost that half. In the district's five plains counties, in fact, Johnson finished not first but fourth, trailing Harris by a total of more than 800 votes. Johnson's support came from the hills, from the five counties in the district that lay on the Edwards Plateau. Not only did he win four of these five counties, losing only in Stone's Williamson County, but he won them by overwhelming margins. If his home county, Blanco, gave him 688 votes to 82 for his nearest opponent, Hayes County's support was also impressive. 940 votes for Johnson, 270 for his nearest opponent. And within those five counties, the distribution of his votes was striking. Although, to the surprise of all forecasters, and Mayor Miller, he won Austin on the edge of the plateau, it was the precincts west of Austin, the boxes in the hills, that gave him a substantial margin in Travis County. The votes he received in Williamson County came in large proportion not from Georgetown and Taylor, the two big towns just below the plateau, but from the hills to the west. And in Blanco, Burnett, and Hayes counties, the other hill country counties, the results followed in general an identical pattern. The deeper in the hills a precinct, the more isolated and remote and poor its people, the stronger the showing that Lyndon Johnson made in it. He was the candidate of the hill country, of one of the most remote, most isolated, most neglected, and most impoverished areas of a wealthy nation. His 3,000-vote plurality, a plurality whose dimensions had been utterly unsuspected, came principally from the farmers and the ranchers he had visited one by one, from the people in whom he had invested time no other candidate for Congress had ever given them, from the people who had on Election Day repaid that investment in kind, giving up their own time, the time so valuable to them, to make the trip, sometimes quite a long trip, to the polling place to cast their votes for Lyndon Johnson. His very willingness to travel to these people may have been an important reason that they supported him. Not only were they neglected, they felt neglected. They had always felt neglected. The people of the hill country had had to plead even to the People's Party. If we do live away up here on the Pernalis River, amid rocks, cliffs, and waterfalls, cedars, and wild oaks, we are not varmints, but have hearts just like men. Brethren, in sending out lecturers, please remember our isolated corner, and send us in time of need. We had an encampment and honestly expected the presence of a big gun with it, but no, we were sadly left as usual. When, finally, a candidate for Congress made the effort to come to them, muddying his shoes to walk across fields to talk to them, they were grateful for his coming. But his effort was no more important than the philosophy he expressed. Saying he was a poor man like them, he also said he was fighting for the president who was helping the poor, for the only president who had ever helped the poor, for the president who, with bank regulations and railroad regulation and government loans and public works projects, had held out government's helping hand to the poor instead of the rich. The people of the hill country had been asking for such programs for a long time. In half a century, only two long caravans had come out of the hill country. One had borne pictures of Lyndon Johnson. The other had borne blue flags. He won that election in the byways, Bill Deason says. Ava Cox says, "That's what made Lyndon Johnson be elected the first time. He told them, 'I know what you people are up against, because I'm one of you people.' And it wasn't the people of the cities who elected him, but it was the people from the forks of the creeks." That was indeed the reason he won, and the reason no politician had thought he could win. The polls had not shown his strength at the forks of the creeks, for no poll bothered with the people at the forks of the creeks, as no candidate visited them. But Lyndon Johnson had visited these people, and they had sent him to Congress. Nothing about his victory, however, was as significant as his reaction to it. "I'm coming back as a congressman," he had vowed, and he had kept that vow. And he had done so fast, as he had lived his entire life fast. He had been perhaps the youngest state director of any New Deal agency. Now he was at 28, although not the youngest congressman he now claimed to be, one of the youngest. He was the same age as his hero ancestor John Wheeler Bunton had been when Bunton had first been elected to public office, only a year older than his father had been when he had first been elected. Was he content? Was he happy now? Even for a day? He was desperately weak, not just because of the appendicitis, but because of the effort that had preceded it. He was later to say that during the campaign's 40 days, he had lost 40 pounds. When the campaign began, 181 pounds had been stretched thin over his 6-foot-3-inch frame. His weight when he entered Seton Hospital is not known, but when he left the hospital 2 weeks later, after 2 weeks of bed rest and a hospital diet designed to fatten him up, his weight was back up only to 151 pounds. On the day after the election, congratulations had arrived in stacks. Phrases in the letters from people who had known him as a boy or as a college student or as a congressional secretary provided a panorama of his life. Marcelite Summey, who had heard him talk of his ambitions in a Johnson City schoolyard, wrote, "You have always had a vision ever since I've known you, and I'm most happy to see that it is being fulfilled for you." Vernon Whiteside wrote, reminding him of the day at San Marcos when I separated you and Babe Kennedy. Arthur Perry, the older secretary who had taken him under his wing when he got to Washington, wrote, "My dear Congressman, do I get a kick out of that? Well, sir, when I used to see you wearing those summer suits in the winter time and skimping on lunches until payday, the prospect of your becoming congressman in the immediate future, I must confess, appeared a little indefinite." Remembering that when he had found himself in trouble, he had turned for help to the younger man, Perry also wrote, "On the other hand, when I recall your presentation before the Civil Service Commission, I might have known I was in the presence at that moment of a budding people's choice." And aware that Johnson was not quite as wholeheartedly a New Dealer as the campaign had made him appear, he also wrote, "We will be expecting you to make a balance the budget speech in the House." Early on the morning after Election Day, Johnson sent for his aides and told them that all the messages had to be answered at once, that very day. Sitting up in bed, smoking one cigarette after another, he began to dictate replies. Many people had expressed a desire to see him so that they could express their congratulations in person, he was told. He wanted to see them, he replied. A schedule of visits should be set up at once. He had a lot of people to see before he left for Washington, and he wanted to leave for Washington fast. The first letters to be answered, moreover, were those not from friends but from enemies, the concession messages from his opponents. And while their congratulations had been strictly pro forma, his replies were not. "You didn't lose," he told Avery, "just as I didn't win. It was a victory for President Roosevelt." He repeated that to Sam Stone. "My dear Judge, thank you very much for your kind telegram. The people voted to support President Roosevelt and his program, and the victory is his." And since the judge would be a more dangerous future opponent than Avery, went on at more length. "You warned me you would show us how to carry Williamson County, and I congratulate you upon the support the home folks gave your candidacy. Please tell your and my friends there that I admire the way they stood by you." And to the opponent he considered most dangerous of all, Polk Shelton, who had campaigned with energy and whose strong beliefs Johnson feared would impel him to run again. His reply went even further. "Thank you for your kind telegram and your pledge of support. I hope you will always feel that my efforts are at your disposal. Whatever service I may be able to render will be cheerfully and gladly done." Letters were not the only means by which he dealt with the men who had been his enemies just 24 hours before. The powerful Mayor Miller, so hostile during the campaign, was leaving for Washington the next day on a long-planned visit. Because Johnson did not yet have a secretary in Washington to show the mayor around, he telegraphed his brother, now Congressman Clayburgh's secretary. Sam Houston had returned to Washington a week before, to do it, and to go all out in doing it, to give him all the privileges and courtesies of the office. Johnson would have to run again in 18 months, and this time he would be running not in a special election, but in a regular primary in which victory would require not the 28% of the vote which he had received, but 51%. Any prudent politician would take steps to try to make friends out of enemies, but even very prudent politicians were amazed by both the rapidity and the extent of the steps Johnson took. The eminently pragmatic Dan Quill had spearheaded the ward-by-ward fight against Miller in Austin. He knew the bitterness of the fight and the depth of Miller's dislike of Johnson. He knew that Johnson had visited Miller's house many times to beg for a truce, and he knew how rude Miller had been in denying him one. Quill, by coincidence, left for a Washington visit on election night, and when he arrived, dropped in to see Sam Houston Johnson and saw the telegram. Pragmatic though he was, Quill could hardly believe that Johnson had sent it. When he had left Austin, Miller had been Johnson's most bitter enemy, and here he had sent a telegram to take care of him. I never saw anything like it. When I got in a fight with a fellow in an election, I didn't forgive him so quickly. I don't know how he did it. I wouldn't have had the nerve to have been nice to those kind of people, but he was. That was just 3 days after the election, and he wanted to be nice to Tom Miller. Quill recalls saying to Sam Houston, I'll tell you, Washington is a big city, but it's not big enough for Tom Miller and me at the same time. To avoid bumping into the mayor, I came back home. Quill did not know the extent to which Johnson had gone to take care of Miller. Because he was afraid his brother would not carry out the task with sufficient diligence, he had asked not only Clayburgh's office, but Maury Maverick's to put itself completely at the mayor's disposal. No effort had been spared to defeat these men. No effort would be spared to win their friendship. One day, before Johnson left for Washington, Emmett Shelton would step out of his office building to walk up Congress Avenue to the Travis County Courthouse, and would see Johnson getting out of his Pontiac, having apparently just parked it. Johnson said hello to Shelton, asked him where he was going, and then insisted that Emmett join him. He would be glad to give him a lift, he said. As they were driving up Congress Avenue, Shelton realized that he had left some papers in his office. Johnson drove him back. Shelton said he would be a few minutes, and said it was no trouble for him to walk to the courthouse. No, no, Johnson said, I'll wait. Glad to. Take your time. And the congressman waited there for Shelton as if he were his chauffeur. And as they talked during the brief drive, he, Johnson, was gracious, very gracious. Though he had disliked Johnson, now, Shelton says, he was just nice, he was humble. More than humble, in fact. He made you feel he was dirt under your feet. Shelton didn't know the full extent of the trouble Johnson was taking to become his friend. Johnson had not, in fact, just parked his car when Shelton came out. He had parked it an hour before, and had been sitting in it for an hour waiting for Shelton to come, to take advantage of the chance meeting. Shelton was not the only opponent thus disarmed. Tom Miller gave Johnson a post-election contribution of $100 to meet any campaign deficit he might have. What might prevent a Dan Quill or another man from behaving to his enemies the way Lyndon Johnson behaved would be pride or embarrassment, or any one of 100 conventional emotions, such as a natural desire to gloat, even for a day or two, over a fallen and vicious foe. But Lyndon Johnson had determined many years before the emotion that would govern his life, the emotion that, with inflexible will, would be the only emotion that he would allow to govern his life. It is ambition, he had written, that makes of a creature a real man. Pride, embarrassment, gloating, such emotions could only hinder his progress along the road he saw so clearly before him, the vision he had indeed held for so long. They were luxuries in which he would not indulge himself. The addresses to which he was sending those letters were not all within the district. Just as he had, as a congressman's secretary, encouraged influential persons from other districts to come to him for help, now, as a congressman, he replied to congratulations from out-of-district influentials with similar encouragement, as in his reply to the publisher of a weekly newspaper in Vernon, near the Oklahoma border, almost 300 miles away. R.H. Nichols to Johnson, congratulations, I remember with gratitude your many services to our family while you were with Mr. Clayburgh. Johnson to Nichols, thank you. Any time I can be of some service to you, I want you to call on me. Influential or not, moreover, anyone who wrote to Johnson was to receive a reply, as fast as it could be typed and mailed. Sitting propped up in his hospital bed, his face still gray with the shock of the operation, he dictated 50 different form letters to be sent out, so that recipients wouldn't realize that the letter they received was a form letter. Among the first letters he wrote were letters to officials of the National Youth Administration in Washington. He wanted them to make permanent Jesse Kellum's temporary appointment as the NYA's Texas director. He wrote, in addition to Sam Rayburn, to Senator Morris Shepherd, to anyone whose intercession with the NYA hierarchy might conceivably be helpful. Keeping control of the NYA was very important to him. It was, after all, a statewide agency, and thus a potential statewide political organization. Just one day after he had become Clayburgh's secretary, Ellis O'Rella had seen that he was thinking this was a stepping stone. As soon as he got a job, he thought, now that I'm in this, how can I use this job for the next step? Nothing had changed. Johnson already knew what the next step was going to be, and for it he needed a statewide organization. On only one group of letters did he delay putting his signature. These were replies to congratulatory letters which mentioned his father. Writing to congratulate Johnson on April 12th, for example, William P. Hobby had mentioned his admiration for Sam E. Lee Johnson. Although Hobby was one of the most powerful men in Texas, a former governor who was now publisher of the Houston Post, and although Johnson immediately dictated a reply to his letter, he did not sign the typed reply for almost a month. Quite a few letters mentioned Lyndon Johnson's father, and his record in answering them is striking, considering the promptness with which all other letters were answered. Some of these letters must have recalled painful memories. E.B. House, for example, wrote, "Your father served as road foreman under me in 1925-26. But others had a very different tone. A.R. Meader, for example, wrote that, "I was raised in Buda, and it was a very happy day to me when Sam Johnson would come to our house and stay all night. My brothers and myself would unhitch the horse from that old buggy. My mother, who was a friend of your grandfather, is now 83 years of age. She was so anxious to cast her ballot for you, but was not able to get out of the car, so she had someone drive her to the polls, and the ballot was brought to the car, so she could vote for Sam Johnson's little boy." No matter what the tone of the letter mentioning his father, the replies were delayed, sometimes for quite some time. The Meader letter, for example, was not answered for more than 3 weeks. Johnson's reply, moreover, contained no mention of his father. Sometimes the same letter would be presented to Johnson for signature over and over, and each time would remain unsigned, as if he could not bear to sign it. The doctors had told him he would be out of the hospital a week after the operation, by April 15th or 16th. A send-off dinner was being planned for the new congressman, and he told the planners to hold it on April 26th, because he was very eager to be off. But he suffered a setback. The doctors told him he would have to rest, but after a day or so he tried to resume working from his hospital bed, and this time there was a more serious setback. Its precise nature is unknown. In referring to it, Johnson aides and relatives used two adjectives, nervous and exhausted. Talking to an old friend, Edna Fraser, on the telephone on April 20th, 11 days after her husband had entered the hospital, Lady Bird said that he was not progressing as he should. Writing to Mrs. Fraser the following day, L.E. Jones reported that two or three times in the last day or two the chief has tried to do a little dictating. Every time it seemed to have a bad effect. So now the doctors won't let him write any letters. We all expected he would be out of the hospital by now. The delay, no doubt, has been caused by the excessive number of visitors. On that day, all Johnson's appointments were abruptly canceled, as were plans for the dinner. He remained in the hospital until April 24th or 25th, and doctors allowed him to leave then only after he and Lady Bird told them that he would be able to rest more quietly someplace out of the district, and that he would not go to Washington but to her father's home in Karnak to spend at least another 2 or 3 weeks resting there. On April 27th, the new congressman went down to the depot of the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railroad with his wife and parents, his face still thin, very white above a dark blue suit. He had told reporters he was going to Washington, and the train did in fact go to Washington. But Johnson and Lady Bird were to get off when the train stopped in Marshall. Her father would be waiting there to take them to his house, where they would rest until Johnson was better. On the long platform there took place a scene somewhat poignant to those who knew something of Lyndon Johnson's relationship with his parents. He walked ahead of his father, alongside his mother. His father was so ill, he would in fact be dead within the year, that he could not keep up and fell behind. Johnson climbed aboard the train before his father arrived at the door. Sam Johnson, however, started to climb up after him and turned up his face. Lyndon bent down, and father and son kissed. Chapter 23. Galveston. Ever since his boyhood in Johnson City, Lyndon Johnson had displayed a remarkable talent for making a favorable impression on older men who possessed power, and for making it with startling rapidity. So keen-eyed a connoisseur of politicians as Ed Clark says, "I never saw anything like it. He could start talking to a man, and in 5 minutes he could get that man to think, 'I like you, young fellow. I'm going to help you.'" At San Marcos, Lyndon Johnson's talent had worked with the president of the college. Now he was to try it on another president. Within a few minutes after he had passed Stone in the balloting and knew he had won, he had telegraphed his friends among the wire service reporters in Washington, informing them not only of his victory, but of the manner in which he hoped they would identify the victor. For what had helped him in the Hill Country could help him in Washington, too. He got the identification he wanted. The Associated Press story flashed across the United States that Saturday night. By Ed Jameson, who sent a copy to Johnson with the inscription, "Hope it suits your Honorable Highness," began, "Youthful Lyndon B. Johnson, who shouted his advocacy of President Roosevelt's court reorganization all over the 10th Texas District, was elected today. He said he considered the result a vote of confidence in Mr. Roosevelt and his program." With news scanty on a Saturday night, the story made front pages of newspapers all across the country, including newspapers in Washington. "Texas supporter of court change appears elected," a Washington Post headline read. Encouraging news was in rather short supply at the White House just then, with Roosevelt's court plan reeling under blows from both House and Senate. 2 days after Johnson's election, the Supreme Court would, by upholding the New Deal's Wagner Act, deliver its own body blow. To reinforce the identification, Johnson asked local supporters to telegraph it to the White House. Said one telegram addressed to Franklin D. Roosevelt, "Election of Johnson to Congress was a high testimonial of your great leadership. Your reorganization of the Supreme Court was made the main issue." This strategy produced the desired effect, and at a timely moment. For the president, who was shortly to leave for a fishing vacation in the Gulf of Mexico, had just announced that he would disembark in the Texas port of Galveston at the conclusion of his cruise, and would begin his return train trip to Washington by traveling the length of the state. On April 20th, someone in the White House placed a memorandum in the president's trip file. "When we get down to Texas, we have to arrange to have the congressman-elect, who ran on a pro-New Deal, pro-court reform platform, to see the president." Before leaving Austin for Karnak, Johnson had asked Governor Allred to do all he could to make sure that the meeting would actually take place, to make sure that it would be photographed, and to ask the president to use his influence to secure him a place, coveted by all congressmen from farming districts, on the House Agriculture Committee. During the 11 days in which the presidential yacht Potomac, escorted by Navy destroyers, cruised off the Texas coast, where the big silver tarpon were running, it touched in at Port Aransas for an hour, and Allred went aboard to arrange details of the Galveston reception. After meeting with Roosevelt, he wrote to Johnson, who was recuperating at Karnak, that the president will be very happy indeed to see you when he lands at Galveston. He was intensely interested in the details of your campaign, and himself brought up the committee matter which you and I discussed. I suggested to him that you all should have your picture made together next week, and this was entirely agreeable. The governor, fond of Johnson, had been disturbed by his haggard condition when he visited him after the campaign. He suggested now that it might be well for you to come on down 2 days early and spend Saturday and Sunday there resting. And when, on May 11th, the Potomac and its escorting destroyers, their crews lining the rails in dress whites, stood into Galveston Bay, and a gangplank was run down from her deck to the pier, Johnson, still very thin, but with a white oleander, Galveston's symbol, cheerful in his lapel, was standing at its foot, along with the governor and a beribboned major general from nearby Fort Crockett, in a 3-man group at the head of the assembled dignitaries. They waited almost an hour. Then there was a stir on deck, and side boys began their shrill piping, and suddenly at the top of the gangplank, just a few feet away, was the massive head, the heavy, confidently tilted jaw, the broad smile that Lyndon Johnson had seen only in newsreels or newspaper photographs, or during a speech from a distant gallery. The face, bronzed by the Gulf sun, of the man whose banner he had carried for 40 days. The gangplank was narrow enough so the President could rest his weight on both handrails at once, and he swung himself down it. When his foot hit the dock, cannon roared in salute from Fort Crockett across the bay. A drum major's baton flashed in the downbeat to "Hail to the Chief." Governor Allred said, "Mr. President, I'd like to present our new congressman." And Franklin Roosevelt shook Lyndon Johnson's hand. The photograph session was all Johnson could have desired. The President stood patiently as the cameras clicked, smiling broadly as his big, bronzed right hand clutched Johnson's. Roosevelt's body concealed his left hand, which was clutching the gangplank railing for support. The next day, a typical newspaper report said, "The President chuckled happily as he went unassisted down the gangplank." Johnson had not been assigned to ride with Allred and Galveston Mayor Adrian F. Levy in the President's open touring car. He rode in one of the trailing cars assigned to lesser dignitaries as the presidential motorcade, thunderous cheers rolling behind it, wound through streets packed with the largest crowds in Galveston's history, to a specially constructed ramp, up which the President's car was driven so that he could speak while sitting in it. Introducing him, the mayor said, "As we were driving along, I told our President that it must be a wonderful thing for a man to know that he is so universally loved. Just as the time of Pericles was called the Golden Age of Athens, so President Roosevelt's time will be called the Golden Age of Democracy." Johnson was, however, on the open rear platform of the President's special train as, at 10 a.m., it pulled out of the Galveston station, with Roosevelt standing on the platform smiling and waving, with his other hand clutching the rail. There were, in fact, two hands on that rail. The other one was Johnson's. Separated from the President by Allred, he reduced the distance between himself and Roosevelt, and thereby kept himself from being cropped out of newspaper photographs, by a subtle little maneuver. The President, beyond Allred, was on his right. Johnson had been holding his white Stetson in his right hand, the hand closest to the President. As photographers began shooting, he shifted the Stetson to his left hand, placed his right hand on the rail, and slid it a few inches toward the President so that he could shift his body slightly in front of Allred without blatantly leaning into the picture. And he, together with Allred, had been invited to ride in the President's private railroad car. When the President left the platform and went inside, the three men, together with White House aides Marvin McIntyre and Edwin M. "Paw" Watson, chatted throughout the three-hour trip to College Station, where the President was to review 3,000 khaki-clad ROTC cadets from Texas Agricultural and Mining College. Only one specific detail of that conversation is known. After his election, Johnson had visited General Burleson to thank him for his support. The old man had given Johnson part of a brown paper bag on which, after Johnson's first visit, he had jotted down a predicted order of the finish in the congressional race, with Johnson's name in first place. President Roosevelt, of course, had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy in the Wilson administration during the years in which Burleson had been Postmaster General in that same administration. If Roosevelt did not know Burleson, he knew who he was, and Johnson showed him the wrinkled piece of brown paper. The conversation's other particulars are not known, although back in Washington, the President would talk about the young man who had defied every entrenched political leader in his district to run, alone among 8 candidates, in support of the court reform bill, and who was incidentally interested in the Navy, as he had himself been as a young man. But the results of the conversation are known. Although Johnson had expected to leave the train at College Station, Roosevelt invited him to stay aboard all the way to Fort Worth, more than 200 miles away. When the train pulled into that North Texas city at 9 p.m., the newly elected congressman had spent an entire day with the President. Before they parted company, the President said that the Agriculture Committee seat was Johnson's if he wanted it, but that he would suggest the Naval Affairs Committee instead. He liked to see a young man like Johnson taking an interest in that field. Powerful as naval affairs was now, he said, world trends might make it more powerful still. When Johnson accepted his suggestion, Roosevelt was delighted and said he would personally see to the matter as soon as he got back to Washington. And he told Johnson that if he needed help in any other matters, he should call Tommy. And scribbling Tommy's telephone number on a piece of paper, he handed it to Johnson. Tommy was, of course, Tommy the Cork, Thomas G. Corcoran, 36, the stocky, ebullient, accordion-playing political manipulator who was at that moment, as one of the president's key strategists in the Supreme Court fight, at the very peak of his power and influence. Roosevelt, traveling by special train, reached Washington before Johnson. He telephoned Tommy himself. As Corcoran recalls the president's words, he said, "I've just met the most remarkable young man. Now I like this boy, and you're going to help him with anything you can." And he helped him himself. On one of Johnson's first days on the floor of Congress, the floor on which, as a congressional secretary, he had never been permitted to step, Representative Fred M. Vinson of Kentucky, a Democratic power on the Ways and Means Committee, whose Democratic members determined committee assignments, approached him and said, "Young man, I'm indebted to you for a good dinner and an excellent conversation." He explained that he had been invited to the White House for dinner, and while the president was, as always, a most delightful host, I kept wondering just what it was he wanted from me. I knew it was something. Finally, he said casually, oh, very casually, "Fred, there's a fine young man just come to the house. Fred, you know that fellow Lyndon Johnson. I think he would be a great help on naval affairs." The president also helped Johnson along avenues less formal than a congressional committee assignment, which of course Johnson received, but to a young politician more important. He talked about him to men much more powerful than Tommy the Cork or even Fred Vinson, to Harold L. Ickes of PWA and Harry L. Hopkins of WPA, talked about this remarkable young man, ordered them to meet him and to help him. "A young man from the Southwest would need connections in New York," the president said to Hopkins, who had excellent New York connections, including not only those who sprang from the same social work background he did, but Edwin Weissel, a New York political financier. Corcoran, even before he met the young man, had been impressed by the speed with which he had won the president's favor. "That was all it took, one train ride," he says. The achievement earned Johnson Corcoran's highest accolade. Whoever the young man was, he said, he must be an operator. Now, meeting him and watching him operate on Ickes and Hopkins, he was even more impressed. Lyndon Johnson's college classmates had thought that his talent with older men was nothing more than flattery, kowtowing, suck-assing, brown-nosing, so blatant that words won't come to describe it. But Corcoran, a king of flatterers himself, knew it was much more. He knew a master of the art when he saw one. He, Johnson, was smiling and deferential, but hell, lots of guys can be smiling and deferential, he says. Lyndon had one of the most incredible capacities for dealing with older men. I never saw anything like it. He could follow someone's mind around and get where it was going before the other fellow knew where it was going. I saw him talk to an older man, and the minute he changed subjects, Lyndon was there ahead of him, and saying what he wanted to hear, before he knew what he wanted to hear. Fanning out from Ickes and Hopkins and Corcoran, branching down from the White House, was a network of New Deal insiders, men of immense power and influence. Soon all along the hidden pathways of Washington power, a new name was flashing, sent out so rapidly that sometimes it was garbled in transmission, but sent out from the highest sources. Elliot Janeway, the young political economist from New York who had already become part of this network, was lunching with Ickes in Washington one day when he heard it for the first time. "Ickes told me Roosevelt had said he was frustrated about that boy, that if he hadn't gone to Harvard, that's the kind of uninhibited young pro he'd like to be, that in the next generation the balance of power would shift south and west, and this boy could well be the first Southern president." Ickes said he had met him, and Janeway should too. "You'll like him." After lunch, Janeway says, "I took the Congressional back to New York," and no sooner had he arrived home than the telephone rang. Ed Weissel was calling to say, "I just had a funny kind of a call from Harry Hopkins. Did you ever hear of some kid in Congress named Lyde Johnson? Below Hopkins and Ickes, field marshals of the New Deal, below Ben Cohen, one of its principal theoreticians, and Tommy Corcoran, for a time not only its principal recruiting officer but one of its principal strategists, were the lieutenants of the New Deal, the able young liberals, fired with a fervent idealism, who had poured into Washington from all over the United States to enlist in the Great Crusade. These men, not cabinet-level secretaries or even undersecretaries, but their subordinates, possessed no independent power of their own, no official title of significance, no White House access, no discretion over the distribution of funds, but they could be important to a congressman. "What is a government?" Corcoran once asked. "It's not just the top man or the top 10 men. A government is the top 100 or 200 men. What really makes the difference is what happens down the line before and after the big decisions are taken." Having met the field marshals and taken them into camp, Johnson repeated his triumph with the lieutenants. He concentrated his efforts on a particular handful of them. One link between these men was the issue of public power. They were all veterans of the fight for either the crucial Public Utilities Holding Company Act of 1935, the Rayburn-Fletcher Act, or of the subsequent battles to administer the act, or of the battles to build the huge dams which, by creating new hydroelectric power, would destroy the utility's monopoly. A dam, the Marshall Ford Dam, was the first problem Johnson had to confront when he got to Congress, and it was during his efforts to solve this problem that he met and dealt with most of these young lieutenants. Another link was intellect. The 100 or 200 key young New Dealers included many brilliant men. Johnson's handful was among the most brilliant. Their leaders were the drafters of the Keystone Act, Corcoran and Cohen, or to be more precise, Corcoran, for the kindly gentle Cohen, who, a friend wrote, looks and talks like a Dickens portrait of an absent-minded professor, was too shy and dreamy to be a leader. His genius was the genius of the lone and pure intellect. Corcoran's performance at Harvard Law had so impressed Felix Frankfurter that he gave him the best job then at his command, the secretaryship to Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. But even so, men who knew them well had learned that Corcoran's mind was not the equal of his silent partner's. After one meeting at which Corcoran did almost all the talking, Sam Rayburn confided to a friend, "Cohen's the brains." The handful included one of Corcoran's successors as Holmes's secretary, James H. Roe, a tall, studious, bespectacled young attorney, in 1937, 28 years old, the same age as Lyndon Johnson, whose path to Washington had led from Butte, Montana, through Harvard University and Harvard Law School. While serving as one of several low-level assistants who were helping Corcoran and Cohen in the drafting of the Holding Company Act and in defense of the PWA against power company lawsuits, Roe had caught Corcoran's eye, and Corcoran had placed him in a low-level White House job, secretary to the president's son James, where he would shortly catch the president's eye. This handful of men included William O. Douglas, 38, a sandy-haired former Yale Law School professor who, as an SEC commissioner, was a key figure in the administration of the Holding Company Act. "The holding company in the utilities field had become a monster," he was to write. And it included the first man Douglas had brought to Washington to assist him, a short, slight, silent young Jew from Memphis, with olive skin, large, liquid eyes, and, another Yale professor says, "the most brilliant legal mind ever to come out of the Yale Law School," 26-year-old Abe Fortas. This book is continued on cassette number 9, side 1.